Welcome to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, pulls it apart and weaves it back together in ways that are easy to understand. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The Hippocratic Oath is a Greek medical text outlining ethical standards for a physician to uphold. However, history has shown us that the standard of care can change depending on race, gender, and class. That's what we're focusing on as our look at caregiving continues this hour. The role these factors play in elder caregiving. Joining us now is Dr. Jonathan Ross, past president of Physicians for a National Health Program and associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of Toledo. Welcome to All Sides, Dr. Ross.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. What improvements need to be made in our healthcare system to make up for those disparities that we see when it comes to gender, race, and class?
Well, I think the easiest way to actually address those things is probably going to be with a system where everybody's in and nobody's out. I think universality, where we're all in one system, is a key feature that all the other rich countries have. And although there's no question, we're still going to have, to some extent, poorer outcomes for those with low incomes. There are ethnic groups which are discriminated against with to some extent now. They'll continue to probably have problems relative to the majority in terms of race, ethnicity, sexuality. But the fact is that with the system, with everybody in and nobody out, with a common set of benefits that are comprehensive, I think that is kind of key to at least making a big move in terms of improving the healthcare. I think the other thing about that system is we need to recognize that the social determinants of health are way more important than whether you get medical care or not. Your income, your education, where you live, your exposure to environmental hazards, all those sort of things are playing a role in whether you're healthy or not. And so we have to actually think, if as we reform our sickness care non-system into a healthcare system, about those social determinants of health and how to integrate healthcare and public health, which addresses those social determinants of health, into a seamless system where those things are working hand in glove.
You called it a sickness care system. Do other countries not treat it like that? They don't treat the sick?
Oh, no, they have. I'm not saying that we shouldn't be treating the sick.
I know that
the whole system can't be focused just on the sick. Mm. You know, the idea is what we need to do is prevent people as best we can from getting sick to begin with. And when people do get sick, to provide them with the care that gets them healthy as quickly as possible. And we have, without any question, we have the best doctors, the best nurses, the best hospitals, the best equipment, the best research. And what we don't have is the system to apply all those things to people who need the care. What we have is the worst among all the rich countries in terms of getting care to people who need it. And so, you know, sometimes I joke around, I say, you know, how do we fix this? Well, first we need a system, right? We don't have one right now. We've got hundreds of insurers, if not more than that, and they're all with very complicated financial arrangements with hospitals and doctors. The financial complexity is astounding. And that financial complexity is probably the most fundamental disease of our American healthcare. The financial complexity sucks huge amounts of resources away from caregiving into chasing money. And most other systems are much more simple, much more direct in the other rich countries of the world. And therefore, they save tremendous amounts of money on administrative expenses that we have to waste money on chasing money here in the U.S.
Now, the closest thing we have to national health care would be looking at Medicare and Medicaid. So Medicare, you do have to pay a premium, but it is available to everyone over 65. But then Medicaid, everyone can get into it, but you have to be very poor. Is that correct? So
pretty much. I mean, one of the things that Obamacare did was to expand Medicaid out to about 140% of the federal poverty level, which made a huge difference. When I was still practicing Center City Medicine here in Toledo, Ohio, it made a huge difference for my patients. So I don't want to belittle some of the incremental reforms that we've tried. I mean, I kind of feel like there's good incremental and bad incremental in terms of taking us toward universality, simplicity, and affordability. That's USA, by the way. I mean, that's what we need. We need a USA system, universal, simple, and affordable. And the best way to get there, at least I've spent a good part of my advocacy life, is through a single payer, improved, expanded Medicare for all. Medicare is constitutional. We don't get into those arguments. It went through the same sort of fight that the Affordable Care Act did with constitutionality. It is affordable and could be made even more affordable if we had it for all, because it's way less expensive to collect taxes to afford in a national health care program than it is to collect premiums. There's a tremendous amount, and not to mention co-payments and deductibles and all the other nonsense that we're faced with in our healthcare system. So the simplicity, and this is according not to John Ross, but to the Congressional Budget Office, the simplicity can save enough money to give everybody comprehensive coverage with everybody in and nobody out, any doctor, any hospital, and we still save money with that program, because there's such tremendous administrative waste in the complexity of the current financing of our American healthcare sickness care non-system. So, and we would have the opportunity in the process of moving towards something like an improved expanded Medicare for all, of having, using some of the excellent public health that we have to prevent more illness. And other countries are in the process of showing that their actual care systems are better than ours as well in terms of improving mortality from treatable illness. We're, the last 10 years or so, almost all the other rich countries who are our economic competitors have managed to significantly reduce the number of deaths related to treatable illness. And we have barely budged in the last decade. People need to have that simplicity of easy access in order to use the medical piece of our healthcare system most effectively.
Now, this idea of a national health program or Medicare for all, would it reduce the disparities that are caused by race and class? I mean, the race issue will still exist.
I don't have any question that we are not going to cure racism with a national health insurance program. That won't happen, okay? That's more in people's hearts than it is in the structure. But having a system that allows us to focus on where the social determinants of health are causing the most illness, and we would have that data, because all the data is going to be in one place, right? Mm-hmm. About whether these minority populations or particular areas, whether they be rural or urban, are underserved, and that providing more service to those areas might actually improve people's health, improve their productivity, improve tax receipts, improve the lives of the people and their children. And I think that's kind of the duty of a democracy. It's to equitably provide for the social, physical, financial, and environmental living conditions that allow its people to thrive. I mean, health is essential to human productivity and joy of living. And if we think about the golden rule, we should care for our neighbors as we would want to be cared for ourselves. And so I think this is getting to this kind of a system where everybody's in, nobody's out. We can begin to make decisions about what will most benefit people. And I think people who have been undertreated, underserved, are much more likely to have improvements in their care and in their life expectancy and in their joy of living by not having to constantly be concerned about whether they can afford care or reach care.
This is Untangled from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about addressing disparities and inequities in our healthcare system with Dr. Jonathan Ross, past president of Physicians for a National Health Program, also a professor of medicine at the University of Toledo. So let's lean in a little bit to the elder care idea and long-term care, because that's what this series is about. How do other European countries handle elder care? Do they have a system of assisted living and nursing homes that are covered under their national healthcare programs?
Yes, most of them. It's like each of these countries has come to an approach to dealing with long-term care and disability and how to care for those people in a little bit different ways. But there's lots to be learned there. There's lots to be learned about if we do go to something like an improved expanded Medicare for All to cover the medical care side rather than specifically this long-term care aspect we're going to talk about. There's lots to be learned. We're the last ones to do this. We can go to school here. We can go look at I'll tell you a quick story. The last country to do an improved expanded Medicare for All was Taiwan. Taiwan had about a third of its population uninsured. And they came and went around the world and looked at all the other healthcare systems. And they said, you know, we really like Medicare. Medicare has this trust fund, which feeds money into the economy, you know, because people tend to get more sick when the economy goes down, right? So this is going to be a steady stream of money fed into the economy, both for healthcare. That's one of the things Social Security does as well. It acts as a balancing lever for the ups and downs of a capitalist economy. And the Taiwanese said, no, we're looking at the efficiency of it. I think they thought, let's do an improved expanded Medicare for All. They covered everybody. Barely an increase in the total, and that's a third of their people were uninsured, barely an increase in the total national health expenditures when they did it. And their outcomes are great. People are happy with it. So there, that was 1995. Actually, U.S. Chinese ethnic health economists from Harvard were some of the people that helped them explore these ideas and put them in place. So we can learn. We can learn from other countries. I mean, we don't have to be so insular to think that if the idea didn't originate here, that we shouldn't copy it and use it to improve our own well-being.
So tell me, as more people here in the United States make it to their 80s and even 90s and need more long-term care, tell me and give me an example, because I know you said every country kind of does it a little differently. So give me an example of a good one.
Let me talk about Germany a little bit, because I've read a little bit about that. And again, I don't want to pose as a long-term care expert, because, I mean, I helped to manage a long-term care facility when I first started practicing decades ago. I did my own family's long-term care for my very elderly mother before she passed away. So I have kind of personal experiences that I think are valuable. But let's talk a little bit about an example. In Europe, and this is true for many of the places, first of all, they have more hospital beds than we do. But they use some of those beds for long-term care. They are not in a hurry, because the hospitals there are budgeted. They're not in a hurry to kick people out of hospital beds to send them home too early, or to send them to, in quote, rehabilitation in a long-term care facility that is understaffed. Because why is it understaffed? Because they're trying to profit the people who own them, which is a huge issue in our country about for-profit care. But almost always in every area where for-profit care is ascendant, we see worse outcomes and higher costs. But let's go talk about Germany again. So in Germany, one of the things they recognize is that, and this is true in our country too, a lot of families are doing a lot of free caregiving, right? And there's a shortage of caregivers. And rather than build more nursing homes, first of all, they use some of those empty hospital beds to keep people from ending up in a, in quote, rehabilitative sort of nursing home. So that's good news. They're efficiently using the existing capital, so they don't have to build as many nursing homes, right? And then the second thing they're doing is they're paying families to be the caregiver. They train them. They give them respite if they want to go on vacation. So, and they keep people in their home. So there's a lot fewer facilities in Germany for long-term care, and they managed to do it as part of their national health insurance program. Nobody goes broke going into a nursing home. So, and again, they avoid a lot of nursing homes by, you know, by having people able to stay home with family. And, you know, wouldn't you think, and I think this is certainly true from my own personal experience, that family often gives better care than the people who don't, aren't family would in the patient's home than that would happen in an extended care facility with people who are not family. That just seems logical to me. Can I actually prove it? No. But it just seems to me, why not, if family is willing to do this? Now, we know that families are spending, on average, the ones that are doing caregiving, 20 hours a week doing this. And of course, what happens when you're spending 20 hours a week on a voluntary basis taking care of the elderly or disabled that are your family members, you're less productive in the economy, right? You could otherwise be working those additional 20 hours in a job that created income and paid taxes. So it's this idea of housing people in extended care facilities is bad economics too, in my personal opinion. That's just as an example. So I don't want to pretend I'm an expert on Germany's long-term care system, but that's my understanding about how they do it there. And there are other places that are doing a good job with this as well. And again, not leading people into poverty. If you want to end up, you have to end up as a disabled person, either elderly or simply from a disability as a younger person, and you end up in an extended care facility, you basically have to bankrupt yourself in the United States of America. Only the most wealthy could afford to do it. Or you can purchase, which is very expensive and not probably a very difficult time for the average income family, you can purchase long-term care insurance, but you can't do it right when you need it. You have to have purchased it well ahead of time. So, to me, and we've got the complexity of it again. Dozens of different nursing home chains, all with different rules and regulations. Some of them for profit, a lot of them not for profit, but the majority for profit. Struggling to get people to work in those facilities, to have enough people, and again, pressure from the owners of the facility to have fewer people to be there to do caregiving. Once again, way better to have families care for people at home and pay them and train them and give them respite if they need it than to have people in institutional environments. So there are things we could do, and we could roll this together. And there we know, because this happened in December of 2020, the Congressional Budget Office actually looked at what would it cost to do an improved expanded Medicare for All. And the answer is we save money because there's such huge administrative savings. We can cover everybody and still save money. They say about $40 billion. I can tell you it would be way more than $40 billion because they didn't really consider a number of things as potential cost savings. And in terms of adding in, and they estimated, what if we added in long-term care? And it was going to cost about an additional $400 billion annually to include long-term care. That was their estimate. Now we're spending somewhere between $4.5 and $5 trillion now, okay? So $400 billion sounds like a lot of money, but in healthcare, and we're already spending a chunk of that, all right? That's already coming out of our pockets. To make it happen for everybody would cost a little more, but let me just point out a kind of a ironic comparison here, because when I was reading about this, I looked up what the Trump, extending the Trump tax cuts would be, $400 billion. You want long-term care for everybody in the U.S.? Just don't give Trump the long-term tax cuts and filter those back to Medicare and Medicaid and expand the eligibility. I think it'd be a way better use of that money than giving it to rich billionaires, which is basically where a lot of that money is going. So to me, it's affordable. Then the question is, what's the model? And again, as I said, when you're doing this kind of thinking, you say, well, first we need a system. And the question is, what system do we have that's truly American and has been proven to work? Guess who? It's good old Medicare. Been in place since 1965. Most people understand it. It's been working. Yeah. The traditional part of Medicare, not the for-profiting side of Medicare, which is the Medicare Advantage, which is a whole other
thing. Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there, though. That was Dr. Jonathan Ross, past president of Physicians for a National Health Program, associate clinical professor of medicine at the University of Toledo. Thanks for being with us today.
All right. Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about racial inequality when it comes to caregiving. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The disparities between Black and white households occur on many levels, from wealth to education and from housing to health. This hour, we're looking at how those disparities affect the quality of care we receive when it comes to caregiving and elder care. Joining us now is Dana Bowen-Matthew, the Dean and Howard H. Green Professor of Law at George Washington University Law School. She also wrote the 2023 book, Just Health, Treating Structural Racism to Heal America. Dana, welcome to All Sides.
I'm so glad to be here. Thank you for having me, Amy.
Do you feel that it's a person's individual health or that the structure of society plays a greater role in the health care of people of color?
I not only feel, but also know from empirical data that it is the greater structures of society that really do determine the outcomes for health, especially with respect to underserved and underrepresented populations.
So it's, so you're saying it's the society. Like, I mean, I'm sure individual health plays a role. You know, people research all the time. Different races have different health concerns, but really society, is it society that is causing the most problems when it comes to everyone having equal access to healthcare?
So, let me rephrase it just a little bit, because it is really important for people to understand that there are many things that determine people's health outcomes and many things that determine their health care. So let me start with health outcomes. The social environment in which we live, work, and play, so where you're housed, what your educational opportunities are, what your exposure to pollution is, what your exposure to good food, recreational space, all of these social conditions that our society gives people access to have much more impact on health outcomes. That is, whether I have a susceptibility to heart disease, asthma, et cetera, than individual health at all. Now, that's not to say that individual health isn't important. So my family's history for heart disease matters. My behavior, whether I exercise and eat well, matters. But those things don't matter nearly as much with respect to how healthy I will be as an adult as the societal conditions in which I live. So that's my health outcome. Mm-hmm. It's also the case that societal access to wealth, income, education, and housing affect your access to health care. Do I have a rural or an urban setting in which I live? So if I live in some parts of the United States of America, especially in the Midwest, in counties that we call frontier counties, I have much less access to a dentist, a doctor, a hospital, or a clinic than somebody who lives in the middle of Chicago or DC. So we have to decide whether we're talking about health or health care. And then we have to decide about whether the individual impacts are as important as the societal impacts. And in both cases, they are not.
And it goes hand in hand. So you have the individual health, the health, and but then all of those societal factors also play a role. You've written extensively about social comorbidities and how they contribute disproportionately to high mortality rates. Can you explain what you mean? What is a social comorbidity?
Certainly. Thank you for the question, because comorbidities are something we talked a lot about during the pandemic. So when we saw Native Americans disproportionately impacted by the number of cases that they experienced, COVID cases, their hospitalizations, and they were disproportionately likely to die, more likely to die than any other ethnic group. We were talking about their comorbidities in a medical sense. So we were happy to talk about the fact that they were more, as a population, more likely to have heart disease, or more likely to have lung disease, or more likely to have other physical infirmities that make it likely for them to have COVID as well. Those are medical comorbidities. But what we didn't talk about as much were the social conditions that exposed Native Americans more prominently and prevalently to COVID. Those social conditions, such as living in crowded and unhealthy housing, having to travel through public spaces instead of being able to stay home and isolate during the pandemic for work, having fewer opportunities to choose healthy diets or recreational spaces. Those were also comorbidities. They were conditions that came along with and related to the COVID itself and made it more likely that the Native American population would experience higher morbidity and mortality, that is sickness and disease, than say white populations. So I call those social comorbidities.
And do you see those impacts of the comorbidities, you know, outside of COVID, but in other minority populations too?
Without question. So one of the groundbreaking reports about disparities in health care was published in 2003. It was called Unequal Treatment, and it was written by the Institute of Medicine at that time, now called the National Academies of Medicine. That report was groundbreaking because it showed for many diseases, Amy, not just COVID, but for heart disease, various forms of cancer, not all, but many forms of cancer, some forms of diabetes, and we're actually making progress closing the health gap on diabetes. But diabetes, asthma, COPD, many, many forms of different disease, incidences of disease had disparities that we saw not only with COVID, but that could easily have predicted that we would have seen it with COVID. So it was no surprise to those of us that were looking at inequalities that lead to disease that the disparities in COVID outcomes were so vast. Native Americans died at a higher rate. African Americans died at a higher rate. Latino Americans died at a higher rate, all than white Americans. And this was because of the social comorbidities. They exist for all diseases.
This is Untangled from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking with Dana Bowen-Matthew from George Washington University Law School. She also wrote the book Just Health, Treating Structural Racism to Heal America. Now, this series that we're doing, we're focusing on elder care, how to take care of our elderly populations, if our society is ready for the increase of more and more people living into their 80s, even their 90s. Do you see a role of race playing, does race play a role in the outcomes of caregiving when we look at nursing home care, assisted living, hospice, that kind of thing? Do you see race in that aspect?
What we do see is a disparate incidence of the kinds of diseases in elder care that are related to low socioeconomic status impacting marginalized communities. So I want to be careful not to say your race makes you more likely to die or be sick as an elder. That's not the case. Your race makes you look more likely in this country to experience the social conditions that are going to lead to quicker death and sicker life as an elder, not your race, but the social conditions that attach to your race. So most importantly are the vast wealth and income disparities that affect elderly populations by race and ethnicity. So we can't say, I don't have the data to say that just because of my race, I am more likely to end up in a nursing home. I can say that because my race is likely to give me a lower income, or my race is likely to give me less access to high quality insurance, I can say those things are making it more likely for elders of marginalized races to experience disparate health outcomes in their later years.
Do we know if minorities tend to have this happen, like have problems with like diseases related to aging earlier, like maybe in their 60s or 70s instead of looking at the 80s and 90s. Is that true?
Sure. Of course, we have data that suggests that, for example, the diagnosis of certain types of cancers are made later in racial minority communities than they are in majority communities. What's important, again, to realize is that that's not because of their race, right? Mm-hmm. It's not because I am Black that I'm diagnosed later. It's because I am Black and I live in a community with fewer opportunities to access healthcare. I work at a job that is higher stress and less likely to give me the income so that I can take regular care of my health. The reason this is so important is because race is a non-biological construct. And what we don't want to do is correlate simply one's racial background with later diagnosis, earlier death, higher mortality and morbidity. The danger of saying race as opposed to the social conditions that are associated with race is that we will blame people for their color and their ancestry when we should be blaming social conditions.
Yeah, and those social conditions, I mean, with all of the advances that we've had in healthcare, people, that's why, that's part of the reason people are living longer. There's been so many advances in healthcare, but those social conditions remain. I mean, have things improved? Are we doing a better job? Or is it the advances of healthcare, but the social conditions have unfortunately remained similar?
So there's lots of data that one of the most efficient ways in which we have preserved the inequalities in the American society is by racial and economic segregation in housing. The lack of affordable housing in our segregated communities in the United States is probably the most efficient way to continue all of the other social disparities that lead to poor health outcomes. Now, residential segregation has improved in some parts of the United States, notably the Southeast and Mid-Atlantic corridors. And it has been the case that when those improvements are made, the access to healthcare, access to clean air, access to food, and so forth improves. However, it's also the case that when we look at the lack of affordable housing, the increasing wealth gap that separates marginalized communities in the United States from majority communities, the lack of control over access to atmospheric pollution, those things are not yet getting measurably better in my estimation, in my understanding of the literature. And as a result, we're still seeing some very key indicators widen the gaps as opposed to improve them. One of the ones that's most troubling is maternal morbidity. The difference between the incidence of death within 1 year of pregnancy or delivery among Black, White, Latino, and Asian moms in this country is actually getting worse. And that is notwithstanding better medical care, better scientific interventions. These are differences that reflect, in my view, structural as opposed to solely individual disparities.
Now, before we run out of time, I wanted to be sure to have time to ask you, when we're looking at assisted living and nursing homes, you know, there's always the affordability factor. But is there also the space factor, whether there's a spot for you? Do you feel like there's certain communities that have to take on the burden of taking care of a relative at home because there just isn't the space they can find in their communities for an affordable bed?
I'd like to respond with some generalities and refer you and your listeners to some of the work that's been done by Dr. Rakaya Yerby on elder disparities in particular. But let me just make some general observations that I believe will be responsive to your question. In the United States, Medicaid is one of the most important insurers or financers of elder care. The difference in access to supplemental income beyond Medicaid for white and non-white communities determines the quality of care and access to better living conditions in the later years. If Medicaid is your only source of financing for nursing home, assisted living, and elder care, then the quality of that care is vastly different than if you have other sources of income. I've experienced this recently. My mother-in-law died recently, but at a ripe old age of 93, having had a wonderful, wonderful life. And the reason we were able to give her the highest quality of assisted living care was because we were not relying solely on Medicaid, even though, like your listeners don't know, she, like I, was African American. The other factor that I am not as up to date on, but I can tell you, there's a case in Tennessee, Litton was one of the plaintiff parties that needs updating, but if it has, if it still has precedential value, then one of the concerns in that case was the fact that nursing homes often identify Medicaid beds and limit the number of other of Medicaid beds that are available in a particular facility. Mm-hmm. If that's the case still, as it was being litigated in that Tennessee case, then that does suggest, Amy, that there is a limited number of beds that are available to those who are dependent solely on Medicaid financing. And once those beds run out, then there'll be no other option than caregiving at home.
That was Dana Bowen Matthew, Dean and Harold H. Green Professor of Law at George Washington University Law School. She also wrote the book Just Health, Treating Structural Racism to Heal America. Dana, thank you so much for your time today.
Amy, it was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we're going to talk about Ohio's demographics when it comes to an aging population. Race, gender, income. How do we treat everyone fairly? That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Our focus on caregiving this hour is looking at how race, gender, and class affect the level of care patients receive. We're now going to look at Ohio demographics when it comes to its aging population, and joining us now is Dr. Kathy D. Wright, Associate Professor and Senior Associate Dean for Faculty Affairs at The Ohio State University College of Nursing. Welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me, Amy.
So when we think about nursing homes, assisted living facilities, having home health aides, how is Ohio doing when it comes to treating everyone fairly, regardless of race, gender, and income? Can people get the care they need?
Yes. Thank you for that question. And unfortunately, in the state of Ohio, as we're becoming an aging state, that we're going to be dealing with a significant issue, and that significant issue being the lack of caregivers and care providers that are needed to provide care in long-term care settings, in home care settings, as well as in assisted living settings. And we know that currently for caregivers in the state of Ohio, that there approximately are 414,000 caregivers that are informal or family caregivers providing this care, which is probably a significant underestimate. And of that, we have 624 million hours of care that are provided at $11.5 billion per year. And so we need to increase the actual workforce in planning for that demand that we're going to have, especially as we get towards 2050. We will need to increase it by 230%.
230% increase seems like a lot in a short amount of time. And is the way to do that to pay the care workers more, or is it also to invest in the people who are caring at home?
Actually, both, really. So one thing that we could do is maybe take a look at some of our European countries with regards to how they're providing assistance for caregivers. For example, in Germany and Australia, there's flexible work scheduling so that caregivers can take care of their family member as well as go to work, provided with compensation also to provide that care. Because unfortunately, another challenge that we have is that the majority of caregivers globally, and not even just in the state of Ohio, are women. And we know that there are income inequities for pay for women, even at younger ages. And so what we find is happening is that women are leaving the workplace sooner to care for family members and friends with chronic conditions or conditions like Alzheimer's disease. And by doing so, there's not as much money that's going into their retirement savings or 401ks. And so they become impoverished by doing something that is so incredibly beautiful and wonderful to do for a family member. So I believe, A, providing more financial assistance for these caregivers so they do not become impoverished, and B, we will need to provide a living wage and a higher income for these caregivers, especially those paid caregivers who are working to provide what we would call activities of daily living, like bathing, dressing, toileting, those types of care activities.
What are you seeing when it comes in terms of race regarding the caregiving? Are you seeing it? Is it disproportionately people who need to leave the workforce in order to care for family, Black, white, Hispanic? What are you seeing there?
Yes. So with regards to race, we're seeing that for, I'll give a good example of condition that many older people may face, especially as they get into their 80s, which would be getting dementia or Alzheimer's disease. And so we know that for Alzheimer's disease, that Black and brown people are twice as likely to get dementia than others. And another interesting piece to this is that when Blacks or African Americans get dementia, they tend to need more care as they get older. And so these caregivers are providing more of, again, as I mentioned, those activities of daily living types of care, physical care, which can be very burdensome and difficult to do.
And this is Untangled from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're discussing caregiving. And this hour, we've been talking about caring for the elderly and how it can look different depending on race, gender, and class. With us is Dr. Kathy D. Wright, Associate Professor and Senior Associate Dean for Faculty Affairs at The Ohio State University College of Nursing. Another factor is where you live. WOSU's reporter Renee Fox used some state statistics, and she found that someone who lives in the Franklinton neighborhood of Columbus is expected to live to the age of 60. But just 4 miles away in Grandview Heights, a person can expect to live more than 20 years longer. And I just found that statistic startling. There's such a wide gap in life expectancy based on your zip code. What do you make of that?
Yes, indeed, there is a wide gap. And much of it has to do with not the racial identity of the individual, but has to deal with social determinants of health with regards to access to green space. We know there's been studies that have been conducted in which being able to look outside your door and see green grass every day instead of disrepair and disarray helps with mental and physical health. Things like having access to walkable streets and neighborhoods and safety, and not having wild dogs running around in the neighborhoods that cause people to not be able to get out and engage in physical activity. So much of it has to do with the environment.
And do we need our cities, our state government, to invest more in these areas? I mean, if you look at the statistics and you find an area where people are only living to an average age of 60 as opposed to 80, what can be done? I know that's a big question. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know what can be done.
Yes, indeed, that is a big question. And sometimes you have to look at it this way. You know, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time.
Okay.
So I think that, you know, this is an elephant of a problem that we have with regards to life expectancy being reduced just because of where you live. So doing small things that we can do, like being more socially engaged with our neighbors and with our friends, is very helpful to our mental and our physical health. Also, from a local government perspective, as well as a state government perspective, really reinvesting into these neighborhoods, and not just from the perspective of gentrifying the neighborhoods to where people can no longer afford to live there, but from the perspective of providing clean housing, clean air, and also providing monetary compensation so that people can then live in a environment that's going to be supportive of their health.
But we've also set up a system where in order to qualify for Medicaid, you mm-hmm. have to be poor.
Yes.
That's just the system we've set up. So that mm-hmm. that's hard because mm-hmm. obviously money can help make people healthier, but then you don't mm-hmm. qualify for some services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then that's where some of the private organizations and local churches and other organizations that can help to bridge that gap mm-hmm. for people who are at that middle of the road income level, as I like to call it, being that they're too rich, mm-hmm. so to speak, to receive Medicaid, but not rich enough that they can receive all of the other benefits of living in an environment in which they can be healthier.
Do you know anything when it comes to gender, whether men or women end up needing more care in their old age?
Yeah, another great question. So, of course, we know statistically that women tend to live longer than men do. In terms of the amount of care that they require, that women would require more care because they're going to live longer and also be prone to having more levels of disability to occur to mm-hmm. them because of the longevity. And also we know that there are certain chronic conditions that are more debilitating and prominent in women, such as Alzheimer's disease and dementias.
But then women also end up being the caretaker more often.
Correct. Yes.
So where do we find the extra women?
Yeah, we need them. And we need to keep them healthy. And, you know, I think that's one piece, too, that we don't spend enough time talking about is how do we keep our caregivers healthy so that they can provide the care longer, because we're going to need them.
One of our other reporters, George Shilcock, put together a map about nursing homes, the number of nursing homes and nursing home beds in Central Ohio. It won't be surprising to know that there are more nursing homes in Gahanna and Hilliard and Worthington than places like Galloway and Groveport. But it was also interesting to me, you know, like the Powell zip code had no nursing homes listed. A zip code like Linden also had zero nursing homes. But then whenever it comes to beds, a place like the Hilltop had two nursing homes, but only 197 beds. So it's very interesting to me that it seems like there's not enough places. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's deserts, nursing home deserts in Central Ohio?
Yes. Now that you've brought that to my attention, that is something that I had not realized or knew about. And I also think that we need to focus on how can we have people age in place and be able to provide care for themselves or make it easier for caregivers to care for them. living in their own homes by doing simple things like providing durable medical equipment, grab bars, safety features, respite for the caregivers. So all of these things, because especially when you're thinking about the African-American culture, which I can speak to because I'm African-American, we don't like to put our elders in nursing homes, our senior elders. We want to keep them out of those places because in our culture, we believe that we are to help our family. It's a more collectivist culture. And so I think the key is, yes, there's probably a need for more nursing home beds, of course, because there does come a time when you cannot continue to care for someone. And I know that personally from my caregiving experiences with my father. But we also need to invest in keeping caregivers healthier, as well as providing supports for caregivers within their own homes.
That was Dr. Kathy D. Wright, Associate Professor and Senior Associate Dean for Faculty Affairs at The Ohio State University College of Nursing. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And support for Inside Caregiving is powered by the Storytellers Trust. This has been Untangled on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.